Morning. The tax committee will come to order, and I think today we're just taking public testimony on the governor's proposals in the tax area. And do we have a quorum? We're not quite to a quorum, so we have minutes as well. But would anyone like to come forward and tell us about your thoughts on the governor's proposals in the tax area? Because if there isn't anyone, we'll just adjourn.
Hi.
Yes, welcome.
Madam Chair, could I just hand out a letter?
Sure. And members, while we're getting that, we're going to, you know, we didn't get to Mr. Vakitz and the governor's 21st Century Commission tax report because we're on the floor. So we're going to reschedule them, and we just don't know when yet. But hopefully soon. We do have a quorum. Representative David, did you get a chance to read the February 16th and 17th minutes? Thank you. Representative David moves the minutes of February 16th and 17th. Discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Thank you. Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm distributing a copy of a letter. We've received a lot of letters from our cities over the last couple of weeks as they started to digest the effects of the governor's budget proposal. And I thought I would just share one that I received last Friday from Ken Park, the Dilworth City Administrator. I think it kind of summarizes a lot of the aspects of the governor's proposal that are of concern to our cities across the state. If I could summarize briefly, and I know you're looking to get a lot of testimony in here today, but Mr. Park really wants to highlight a couple of things for you. Number one, in December of 2008, cities did take a $66 million cut in the unallotment that was done to help balance the short-term budget deficit. And for the city of Dilworth, that was about a $64,000 reduction at the very end of their year. And he said with little notice that they had to absorb that cut into their budgets. He also highlights the fact that under the governor's proposal, the cuts for 09 and 2010 would be about $90,000 and about $186,000 for the city of Dilworth. And he goes on to talk about the effects of levy limits and how those will make it difficult for the city to respond. But I think one of the most important things that he highlights on this letter is the fact that even if they didn't have levy limits, simply the property tax increases that would be necessary to replace part or all of the lost state aid would be really, really onerous for their city residents. And I think this is something very that you should really pay attention to, because I know a lot of the cities across the state are going to be looking at the implications for their taxpayers, and I know he feels strongly that it would be very difficult for the city to recover all of that loss of aid from the property tax. Again, as I said, in short or to summarize, this is very indicative of the responses we're getting from cities across the state. It covers the LGA cuts, it covers the market value homestead credit reductions, and again, it's just difficult, given the budget cycle that cities are on, for them to accommodate those cuts as they are proposed in the governor's budget, and as we probably will see in whatever budget balancing package is finally enacted. Madam Chair, with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Others, please. Welcome.
Chair, members, my name is Steve Peterson. I'm with Flaherty and Hood here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. In the property tax division, I asked members to think back to where they were in 1998. Today I'm going to ask them where they were 9 weeks ago. A little reminder, it was cold outside, it was snowy, and there was a big snowstorm coming the next day. Very similar today, not a lot has changed. What did occur that day is the governor did cut $66 million from aid to cities with less than 2 weeks in their budget cycle. And now the governor is looking at cutting again in 2009. But I want to say that the cuts that were done with 2 weeks left in their budget cycle in 2008 are occurring in 2009. With some cities, I'm going to talk about Brainerd specifically at this moment, they are doubtful they have enough reserves to actually make it to their first tax payment and LGA payment, the city of Brainerd, that is. They were asked to reduce $317,000 in their unallotment, and the 2009 cut is $413,000 for 2009. So when I hear the governor and the commissioner talk about being 5% of levy plus aid, yes, technically that is true. The 2009 cut is 5% of levy plus aid. But we are cutting 2008 and 2009, and when you add those together, you're talking to upwards of 9% of levy plus aid in 1 year. Now I'm going to ask you to go back to 1998. Carlson was governor, Clinton was president, Google was two guys in a garage, and LGA was $368 million. The governor's budget proposes that we go back to $368 million of LGA in 2010, 12 years later. This is a 31% reduction in local government aid. This is real money. For the city of Bemidji, they're looking at a $670,000 cut in 2010. This equates to 12 police officers for the city, double their entire budget for capital equipment, 100% of their parks and library budget. To recoup this aid, it would be a 22% increase in their levy in 2010. But we go beyond the cuts in services and the tax increases and the impact on budget for why the CGMC objects to the governor's budget. And that's because LGA is more than a budget item, it is a tax policy item. There's a policy set forth in the early 70s that said geography should not be the determining factor on the quality of services you get and the taxes you pay for them. It said that cities with low tax bases should not have their residents overburdened with high tax rates, and cities with high needs should not would be assisted in taking care of those needs without overburdening their citizens with high tax rates. And the governor's budget retreats from that policy, and it's for that reason we object to the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Question, Wes and David, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, we understand that you don't like the cuts, but I've got a question, two questions. Number one, so that we could restore LGAs, which taxes would you raise, number one? And number two, if you don't raise taxes, what other programs would you cut?
Good question. Representative David's missed there. The CGMC has not proposed specific cuts or revenue raises at this point to recoup those aids. I will say, though, that we were 24% of the unallotment, and we are proposed to be 12% of the governor's cuts, and we are 3.3% of the budget, city aids and credits. So we feel that it is disproportionately being put on to the cities at this moment.
Representative David.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Peterson. When the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities comes up with their tax revenue raisers or their cuts in other areas, would you please contact my office, and we'll have your people talk to my people.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nauman, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director for Metro Cities. We represent cities in the metro area before the legislature and Met Council. I want to talk to you today about the cuts in the governor's budget to local government aid and the market value homestead credit. We do respectfully oppose the level of cuts in the governor's budget. Local government aids are the linchpin of the state and local fiscal relationship, and the level of cuts in this governor's budget would significantly diminish that state and local partnership, a partnership that has been in place for several decades. City services are not glamorous, they're not sexy. They do provide the basic services that we all rely on to go about our daily lives, things like police and fire, parks, roads, libraries, and the like. They do, again, provide the services and the infrastructure that help create jobs and a strong economy. So I would argue that actually the level of cuts in this budget are counterproductive to providing services that will help our state to move forward. We do know that this crisis is likely to get worse, and we do not underestimate that, nor the work that you have ahead of you in solving this budget deficit. We would like to be partners with you in this work and to work on solutions that are more structural and forward-thinking and that help to enhance and not diminish the state and local relationship, and that also will provide reforms that so we do not have a situation that where aids are so volatile when the state's revenues are so go up and down. In 2003, which was the last time we had a budget crisis of this magnitude, cities did withstand major cuts to LGA and the market value homestead credit. They turned the fat and from their budgets and did the best they could to withstand the cuts that were done in 2003. Many cities now are getting down to the meat and the bone. Many, and as a result, some of the basic services that we all take for granted will end up being cut as a result if these budget cuts do go forward. I will just ask you to keep our cities and the citizens and businesses they serve in mind as you work toward a budget solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. President Downing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe a question for both testifiers. I'm curious if within your organizations there's any, I don't know, kind of historical effort or maybe one currently that would identify places where shared services, you know, kind of ways for you to optimize across jurisdictions that would perhaps provide a cost savings opportunity here as compared to simply relying on continuation of LGA. Do you guys have initiatives like that? Is there work underway to try and find those opportunities from within your organizations as compared to being imposed from without?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, many of our cities, we don't track that information specifically, but many cities in our metropolitan area do indeed share services and purchasing where it makes sense. I'd be happy to talk with you further about that. We have been having conversations about that with representatives from the League and other city organizations, but I'd be happy to try to do some work. And I know there's an effort being done on the school side with this, and that some conversations have been taking place about including cities in that. And again, many of our cities already do these kinds of shared services, and I'd be happy to provide some examples to you if that would be useful. I don't have those in front of me, but I'd be happy to get back to you.
And if I may, for clarity's sake, because not everybody knows who everyone is here necessarily, Ms. Nauman, maybe you could tell folks who you represent when you say metro cities. It's both LGA recipient cities and non-LGA recipient cities, right? So if you want to tell, we used to call it AMM,
yes.
So I think Metro Cities confuses people. Maybe you can explain who your membership is.
Totally. Thank you, Madam Chair. Metro Cities, our official name is the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. We are still officially AMM, but we did a little bit of a branding effort a couple of years ago to make it easier to know who we are. We do represent cities. We have about 85 members in the metropolitan area, 7-county metro area. Some of our cities receive LGA, some do not. I'd say about half receive LGA and half do not receive LGA. Most of our cities do receive market value homestead credit, but we do have a pretty wide range of, you know, we represent Minneapolis and St. Paul, the, you know, core cities, inner ring, developing cities, and cities on the outer fringe.
Thank you. Representative Downey, further?
Just maybe a follow-up comment. Thank you for the clarification. Just the sense that you know, these cuts hit, or this financial crisis hit, so we seem to be caught flat-footed, and it would seem to me that an ongoing initiative on the part of your members, irrespective of whether there's budget cuts looming or a financial crisis looming, would be just good planning. And when we look at being able to kind of optimize across the state, doing things across city boundaries and sharing services like 911 and other things that are pretty easy to share, if we had those things in the queue, we could react quicker in a situation like this as compared to simply starting from scratch now that we've got a budget shortfall. So the question is whether you do that kind of as a matter of course in your organization, and if not, maybe a suggestion that that would be a good thing to start just for the long haul. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Further testifier, please. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thanks for taking testimony this morning in front of this committee. My name is Dave Engstrom. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, and we represent cities that are population 5,000 and less in Minnesota. And all of our members are members of the League. However, we specialize in those issues that might affect the cities of 5,000 and less. A lot of those cities are rural. We do have some metro members also. Just to give you an example, I think it's 854 cities currently in Minnesota. A little over 700 of them are less than 5,000. 630 of them are less than 2,500. 500 of them are less than 1,000. And those cities that are 1,000 and less received an exemption or were not unallotted in the last Indiana allotment that the governor announced. I think partially, and from what I've heard, there was some testimony from the city of Williams, which is way up in Lake of the Woods County. And the city of Williams flatly stated, actually through the League president, but they sent their testimony in, that if they did not receive their LGA payment, they may go bankrupt. They couldn't make a payment on a bond that would be due if they did not receive their payment. They had no reserves. Most of our cities, particularly the smaller ones, have few reserves to fall back on. efficiencies and consolidations in some of our cities can be very difficult to address. A little bit of Representative Downey's question. We do have cities that have attempted consolidation. We have five cities in the metro area out in the St. Croix Valley, which have gone through the shared fire service contract, shared police contract, contracting with the county sheriff. And there are other examples similar to that. I was reminded this morning of Cook, Minnesota, which decided that maybe would attempt to contract with the St. Louis County Sheriff for their police services rather than to continue their own individual police department. The price they got from St. Louis County Sheriff because of the proximity of Cook to the rest of St. Louis County was in excess of what they were actually paying their police officer. They've opted not to provide police service and call 911 when you need police, and hopefully the St. Louis County Sheriff will get there. As I said, small cities have few reserves. The LGA cuts will directly affect employment, particularly in rural Minnesota. Most of our cities have a city clerk, maybe a part-time backup, and maybe a maintenance person. That's what those cities 1,000 and less have. And so a cut in LGA, which they are dependent on, will be difficult. Back to that consolidation of services, when you look at the geography of some of our cities, even consolidating police can be difficult due to proximity. A lot of cities have actually gone out of the police department business. I don't have a figure of how many, but they've contracted with the local sheriff. Sometimes running, if you talk about consolidation of sewer or water, it's very difficult. You'd have to run pipes for many, many miles. It would be difficult and financially, more than likely financially impossible. But LGA cuts in our small cities will directly affect employment, mostly in rural Minnesota.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I'm Bill Barnhart. I'm here on behalf of the North Metropolitan Mayors Organization. Follow your suggestion. This is a group of around 20 cities, primarily on the north side of the metro area. And a most recent development that associate members, Hennepin County and Anoka County. I only want to make 2 points. The size of the cuts and disparities. And the size of the cuts, I agree with what Mr. Peterson said and Ms. Bauman said. Enough said. Disparity, the differing ability to raise revenues and the differing expenditure needs. Normally, we think of this as a metro outstate dichotomy. I want to use some statistics in the metropolitan area. Among cities of over 2,500 people, even in the metropolitan area, there is great disparity in the ability to raise revenue. When you're looking on that group of cities at the tax base per capita, in fact, the ratio is as high as 6.5 to 1. That's before fiscal disparity. Even with fiscal disparities, it's 5.4 to 1. It does mitigate it somewhat. It certainly does not erase it. On the need expenditure side, within the context that need can be debated and is always a great debate, in the current LGA formula, there is a need measure. Again, among cities over 2,500 in the metro area, the ratio there on a per capita basis is as much as 3 to 1. The point is that a program such as LGA, a robust program such as LGA, is needed both on a statewide basis and a metropolitan basis.
Thank you, Mr. Barner. Thank you. Further testifiers. Good morning.
Morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike McGuire. I'm proud to be the mayor of Eagan, Minnesota. And I'm here as the chair of the Municipal Legislative Commission to testify on its behalf. I want to thank you for having me here and for the work that you all do as well. I'm here to comment on the governor's proposal and on aids and credits to our local governments. The Municipal Legislative Commission is a coalition of 14 suburban communities who receive no local government aid and participate only in the state's property tax relief market value homestead credit program. So I'd like to start and first address the proposed cuts to the market value homestead credit program. The market value homestead credit is a state-funded property tax relief program that I believe you all have handouts on some of the program specifics. Our cities in the LMC occasionally receive return credit payments, and for us, the market value homestead credit has come to be an unreliable and unpredictable part of our budgeting process. Homeowners in our communities receive a state-sponsored credit on their property tax bills, reducing their property taxes and revenues to our cities. The problem comes when the state fails to reimburse cities like mine for that property tax relief credit to taxpayers. In short, while the state giveth, the state also taketh away. Cities set their levies expecting to receive the market value homestead credit reimbursement from the state, and when the check doesn't come, it causes budgeting problems for our cities. The unpredictability of this funding is routinely tied to state deficit problems, and best demonstrated in the fact that in 5 out of the last 7 years, the state has failed to reimburse MLC cities to help solve state budget deficits. The table on the reverse side of the handout you have shows the impact on MLC communities of that failure. I ask you to keep in mind that this is a state property tax relief program. Cities like mine provide their own form of property tax relief through prudent budgeting that proactively controls costs, maximizes efficiencies, and plans for the future. I'm here to ask that you help us avoid continued budgetary instability and unpredictability by simply taking us out of the middle of state property tax relief efforts. The communities of the MLC ask that this program be reformed and that instead of reimbursing city governments already weary and guessing will they or won't they, provide property tax relief directly to homeowners that need it. This would make property tax relief efforts equitable and transparent while making our budgets more stable and predictable. Additionally, I'd encourage your colleagues and you to take a close look at the VOS database information that will be released in March to assess the market value homestead credit and determine whether or not the program continues to be necessary. The MLC strongly supports focusing property tax relief directly on individuals, reducing property taxes for people who need it most, and property tax relief programs such as a PTR or circuit breaker, which is a better approach to target assistance where it is needed most. Finally, as I noted, none of our cities get local government aid, and we're not asking for it. We understand the importance of local government aid to other communities, but also believe it's important to have an approach to aid that is equitable and understandable. The current LGA program is hard to understand, and it's difficult for me to explain to my constituents why some cities get varying amounts of local government aid, and still others, like Egan, get none. While we don't benefit from the program, we don't advocate the program be eliminated. But the current budget crisis provides the opportunity to re-examine the LGA program. I'd encourage you to be respectful of the challenges and choices locally elected council members and mayors like myself need to make, while making sure that the focus of local government aid is on core city services that similarly situated cities are being treated in similar fashions. I thank you for your time, Madam Chair, and for that of the committee, and I will do my best to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you for coming, Mayor McGuire. I do want to just ask you if you know this. I'm sure you do, and I've heard it before, but just for the committee's perspective, to hear someone come and speak on behalf of 14 cities is not very common here. And this organization, of course, as you said, represents the 14 cities of 854. Can you tell us the population of those 14 cities collectively? Because it sounds really tiny, but it's a big percentage.
Yeah, the Legislative Commission represents 14 suburban communities. Our population totals in the neighborhood of 700,000 Minnesotans, I think a little bit north of that probably. And for further answer, if I can, Madam Chair, in those 14 communities, we have 500,000 Minnesota jobs.
Okay, thank you for that. I appreciate so people know. Representative Lanning and then Representative Rappel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mayor, I just want to be sure that I'm clearly understanding what you're proposing or your organization is proposing. Are you suggesting that we take the state's appropriation for market value homestead credit, that full amount, and put it into the PTR program?
Madam Chair, I'm suggesting that in large part with the caveat that I believe that the credit that currently is applied to property tax holders individually be removed from the tax bill, and that in shifting that the way that's paid, that the levy that my city puts on our taxpayers not be reduced, and the revenue from that levy not be reduced to our city, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Trustee Lanning for this. Trustee Grapple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And good testimony, especially regarding the impact on city budgets. Just something I want to get your opinion on is we're hearing some chatter in the hallways right now, and one of the complaints that some people are making is that cities like Farmington and Lakeville and Eagan, we did not take the full 5.1% cut that other LGA communities did. That I think, you know, and I'm pretty sure, I don't know if the numbers, but Eagan and Farmington are probably in like the 3% range because they took everything from us they could. And there is chatter that one of the revenue-raising possibilities may be that those communities that haven't paid their fair share are actually going to pay a surtax or pay something back to the state of Minnesota to get them back up to 5.1% like other communities. Now, I know where I stand on that. Could you maybe articulate for your organization why this would be a really bad idea?
And Mr. Mayor, is Western Garoppolo's district, are you part of the MLC cities? You know, I don't think
Lakeville
so. Lakeville is Farmington, yep. Is not.
I don't.
Right?
I believe that's correct. Yes.
Okay, I'm just trying to get perspective here. So, okay, thank you,
Madam Chair, and Representative Graff. Thank you for the question. Our market value credit payment was the second half of it was unallotted last year. To the tune of $400,000 to the city of Eagan, and we anticipate that in the next budget coming up, that we would have gotten about $800,000. That represents about 3.5% of our general fund, the challenge to communities like mine, and I believe MLC communities, is in the predictability of the market value credit, not in our reliance on it. In part because we have developed cash flow reserves that we can use as emergency funds when those checks don't come. I would respectfully submit that our property taxpayers have contributed to those cash flow accounts in part because, with all due respect, we've come not to trust the state in delivering that check every year. And so we've done what we need to absorb the hit if it should come. And as I suggest, in 5 out of the last 7 years, that's proven to be a wise approach. It makes up 3% of our 3.5% of our overall budget. We can plan around that if we get taken out of the middle, and that, quite frankly, is what we're asking for.
That's true.
Justin Grapple, please.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Mayor. I agree with you, and I respect that. What I'm talking about is something new that hasn't been introduced yet, where they've already taken from us everything we need to get from the state. I'm talking about them coming to us and making us pay. And,
yeah.
And maybe if you could just articulate, I mean, sure. I think you and I are in sync on this, at least I hope we are, that this would be a bad idea, and maybe you speak on behalf of your organization, talk about why that would be a bad idea.
Part of those cash flow accounts and reserves are funds that we use to fund things like renewal and replacement of city infrastructure and equipment. And if the state were to come and ask for the city of Eagan, for example, to pony up more, we would be drawing off of those efforts to be able to do that. And we would have to make, we would be running uncomfortably low in terms of our reserves to do that. You know, I think one thing you want to keep in mind, and I hope I'm answering your question, Representative Garoppolo, is we get on the city level 4 paychecks a year, market value credit, 2 of them, property tax for 2 of them. If we miss a paycheck or we don't get a paycheck or don't get 2 of them, we have to have somewhere to go to be able to maintain and continue our small and focused menu of city services and to continue to make important investments so that we don't end up having to charge our taxpayers more to repair infrastructure that we've let deteriorate. And we would have to pull off of those cash flow accounts to be able to do that. I hope that more directly answers your question, Representative Garofalo, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Garofalo, yes.
Basically, you would be strongly opposed to any such measure to tax the cities.
I would be significantly less measured in that situation than I am today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. I think Representative Garofalo has hit on a really good point that I think I'm just trying to ask staff to maybe respond to some of the discussion here. And, you know, this is the problem that's going to happen for all of us here in this committee. This is absolutely the issue as it relates to assistance from the state for cities and counties, townships, small cities is, you know, when you're giving it to folks, it's a lot easier based on some measure of need, even if you could all agree on what that is. When you're taking it away, it's much more difficult because if some cities don't receive anything, you can't take anything away. And so just the process of cutting or unallotting or having a deficit is inherently more unfair to recipient cities. So if you're an LGA city and I'm not, and Mayor McGuire is not, you're going to hurt more because you can go in and take away someone's LGA. You can't take it away from these cities. I do, though, want to ask Mr. Michael, I know there are other things, though, that, you know, people will say that these cities don't, you know, get anything from the state, and that's, you know, they do get market value credit, and you've heard testimony that they get pension aid, they get, in fact, many of these cities get dramatic school funding. So there's a lot of things going on in the tax system that may not affect the city structure, but affect the residents of those cities, where they are receiving a lot of assistance from the state. So I was just wanting to ask Mr. Michael if you can think of which ways, you know, sort of cities receive assistance beyond just the typical LGA and market value credit kind of way to think about it.
Madam Chair, I think you've hit on one key one, which is the pension aid for the police and fire pensions. Another one that's somewhat more difficult to use to realize budget savings for the general fund would be a municipal state street aid, which cities that have populations above 5,000 get. That's dedicated money that has to be used for roads. So you would have to get into some gymnastics whereby you would cut LGA more and then reallocate more street aid to LGA cities or something like that to realize it. But those, I think the pension aids and the municipal stage street aid are the two big categories of other intergovernmental aids that the state transfers to these cities that have higher tax bases and therefore don't get LGA.
I think, and we have a question from Representative Marker, but if I may ask Ms. Dalton, I was thinking about my city, just a framing in my head as you were speaking, Mayor McGuire, and I thought the city of Bloomington was proposed to lose $1.3 million in market value credit, and I guess that's kind of right. But the point, that sounds like a big number to members. Well, they're going to lose that, but it's still not as deep a cut as is proposed to LGA recipient cities. So the Bloomington number is about 2.2% versus the LGA cities being 5 or 9 or whatever. So I think Representative Garofalo is right to highlight. We might kind of disagree on where we're going with this. But what I'm saying is you can take cities around the state and you can see by even trying to pull everything back from them, and I know they all feel like they don't get anything, but the truth is they all get something, it's harder to fairly kind of do across-the-board cuts. So even in a city like mine that received or was proposed to get cut $1.3 million in market value credit and, in fact, supports what Mr. McGuire, what Mayor McGuire has just said, my city is on record, as Representative Lanning asked, to abolish market value credit straight up. And you think, well, why would they do that? Well, as the city council members who are working for the city, you know, they're the ones who are getting the downside. If the city cuts the funding or if the state doesn't give them the money, they've budgeted for it now, and they have to go into reserves or do something else. So they're saying, look it, just put it into the BTR, give it in the circuit breaker, and just abolish market value credit straight up. And do that based on needs for individuals, a direct relationship between the state and the taxpayer, and leave us, the cities, out of it, because then you pull the rug out from under us. So I understand that, and my city has that same position, and I think it's something this committee bipartisanly really needs to look at. Should we abolish market value credit? We need to think about that. But if Ms. Dalton can kind of frame these whole issues of what are the range, whether it's in this governor's proposal or if the Democrats put forward another one, you know, how, what is the range that we're seeing and kind of who's going to hurt? And is it, you know, is it 9-0 or is it 5-1 or Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, levy per fate is what is used as kind of the base for making these cuts. And the percent of levy plus aid that's actually made up of aid really varies a lot between cities. The lowest one I could find, just doing a quick ballpark estimate, is the city of Edina, and their market value credit makes up 1% of their levy plus aid base. We have cities, particularly in rural Minnesota, where their levy plus aid, over 50%, 60%. I don't know. I think there's somebody who's at 70%, but I'm not entirely positive of that. The highest I found is 66% of their levy plus aid base is actually made up of LGA. That's not counting their market value credit. So there are some cities that are incredibly dependent on aid, and there are some cities that there's essentially nothing coming from the state in general purpose aid.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt and Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I really appreciate your line of thought here because I guess as the division chair, I'm very concerned with this kind of we versus they attitude and remarks that I'm hearing. This isn't LGA cities versus non-LGA cities. And if you only look at LGA, that's an inaccurate picture, as the chair was just trying to allude to. I mean, we can go back, and I'm mentioning this because just for mention, because I don't want to go to these fights anymore. We're beyond that stage, hopefully. But back in 2001, where there was a transit aid takeover by the state, I know some cities in the suburbs, that was $3 to $4 million of property tax relief. That was the state.
Mm-hmm.
When we looked at the property tax refund program and renters refund program, that's about $950 million over a biennium, almost as much as LGA. And a disproportionate amount goes to cities with higher valued homes. You know, we've got seniors in here that are talking about a cap, you know, cap it at 5% or 6%. And it's not in rural Minnesota where they have to worry about that. It's where they've lived in this home for 30 or 40 years and the market value is now $300,000 to $400,000. So those benefit people living in those suburbs. So when we dish out PTR, that's a benefit to your city because it's lowering property taxes for residents to be able to remain and live viable in your cities. So I just caution members that when you get into this debate, it's not just LGA or no LGA. It's very much more complex. And if we were to look at many of the other areas under property tax aids and credits, and I'm going to use this property tax refund one is the huge one. Last year when we extended the maximum by 27%, that didn't benefit rural Minnesota. That benefited those who live here that have the higher valued homes with higher property taxes. That's who that benefited. And that's the last you're going to hear me talk about it because I'm not getting into these debates. I just want to warn members that there are two sides to this. And as we debate all of this, we need to come together as a state as one. Rural, metro, LGA, non-LGA, we can't have this division. And all of these programs play a very valuable part in the system. Now, I agree we need to look at all of them. This year, we've got to start from ground zero and look at each and every one of these programs. But thanks for allowing me to indulge, but we just need to have caution when we get into this thing.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, and then we have Representative Anderson and Lafferty.
And Representative Mark, I can't agree with you more. And I hope that my testimony here today does not leave the impression that I have nothing but the utmost respect for my colleagues in cities that have real challenges and real choices and have to really consider LGA heavily. My community is fortunate in that we don't have the needs that those communities do and are able to meet them more effectively than some of those other communities. But that is not to suggest that they're doing anything wrong or making bad choices. And I want to be really clear about that. That's what those colleagues, my colleagues in LGA cities as well.
And Mr. Mayor, thank you. And you were clear in your testimony that you did not support getting rid of LGA, even though your city is not a recipient. And it's of note for the members of this committee that this mayor has not even mentioned fiscal disparities, and these cities are the cities that, I think except for two, are the contributors to the fiscal disparities program that assists all the rest of the metro who are LGA recipients. So we appreciate that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my comments are the fact that in your comments you stated that these cities that don't receive LGA and are not paying their fair share in the burden. Is that the correct assessment? Was that what you, because that's what I was hearing. Okay. Well, I'm a little alarmed, and, you know, Representative Garofalo's comments that there's thoughts out there that these cities that don't receive LGA should be paying in a surcharge because they aren't paying their fair share. And my concern is if members are thinking about going down that route, you got to remember that it's the people in these communities that don't receive LGA or having their market value homestead credit value cut are the main contributors that support programs like LGA. And if you don't feel that they're not paying their fair share, I think you need to rethink that. So.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I just want to be fair. I've never used that term, fair share, so I'm not sure who that was. But I'm trying to clarify here that people may not... The same city that Representative Anderson, I think, was just talking about, who don't receive LGA and get market value credit and are contributing, are also asking to abolish market value credit. And that's what I think Representative Lanning's question was. He wanted to get that straight on the record. And I think that's surprising to people to hear. And people just need to think about that. The cities who don't receive LGA, who do receive market value credit, are publicly testifying, and I have been told this in my city as well, on the record, they are okay with abolishing market value credit. So, I mean, people need to think that through. That's pretty amazing. So they're not saying the part that we get. They're saying, you know, let it go away because it's creating havoc in our budgeting process and put it into the circuit breaker instead. So I don't want Mr. McGuire to not get a fair shake here. He's coming here saying we're not a large recipient and you can take away more, because we'd like to be sort of left alone and budget fairly and keep us out of your sort of, you know, situation with taxpayers. So people just need to be clear what's being said here. So I think it's a very, you know, I give you a lot of credit for coming forward and saying this. So, I mean, you usually get flogged, and you're still...
Madam Chair, I remain concerned about the possibility.
And you know, we all show a little bit who we are, and I'm doing that now because if you want to talk about who the city is are who don't get all these things, you know, I think Bloomington's the poster child, yet I agree with the mayor that we should keep LGA. My city is the largest fiscal disparities contributor. We don't receive LGA, yet my city is not coming forward saying give us some. It's saying get rid of one of them. So they're helping the budget problem here, and I think people need to hear that, and it may be where we need to go. So, Representative Loeffler, Coles, and Broad. Representative Loeffler.
Well, Madam Chair, this is just taking us back a little bit, but Ms. Dalton had kind of shared how communities really vary as a percent of levy plus aid in various state revenue streams that they get. But we've been wrestling with it in Representative Dietrich's committee on benchmarks, or subcommittee on benchmarks, with how some of the old traditional measures may not be the ones that we need to go forward. And just as when the state has hit tough budget choices in the past, they've turned to other revenue sources, fees and charges and surcharges and other sorts of things, our cities have gotten very creative as well in terms of, in fact, my mayor, I think, just proposed a lighting fee to pay for the streetlights outside your home or your business. And so I think that we need to look at that, because it used to be you could think of a city budget and you'd put together what your basic needs are, and then you'd track out your state aids, and then that was what you would levy. And now there's other revenue streams in there, so I think we need to really look at how cities really vary in terms of their ability to generate those other revenue streams as well.
Thank you. And before us, I'm called Mayor McGuire. I don't know, but we have been told that the 10th grade class, or 12th grade students from the Burnsville Learning Center, we've heard the Burnsville Learning Center actually resides in Eagan. Is that true? Yes. Okay, so we want to welcome, and you have the mayor of Egan right here, what serendipity. We want to welcome you, the 12th grade students of the Burnsville Learning Center, to the tax committee today. So welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, represent Colton Budd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for not being here when the meeting started, but I'm finding the conversation around eliminating or potentially eliminating market value homestead credits interesting. I know that I have communities who are non-LGA recipients, and I have communities that I represent that are LGA recipients, and I'm thinking out loud, which I recognize is somewhat dangerous to do, but it would seem to me, Madam Chair, that the same logic could apply, and we could make a decision to eliminate LGA and throw all that money into the circuit breaker or some other property tax relief program, and the same logic would apply to getting rid of market value homestead credit. I mean, the communities I represent, one that I'm thinking of in particular, Norwood Young America, I had a long conversation with the city administrator when the unallotment occurred, and they lost a significant amount of their LGA. And they then saw that, the governor's proposal to take away additional LGA in the next biennium, and they're concerned about the stability of LGA, just like communities are concerned about the stability of the market value homestead credit. And I don't think he's been authorized by his city council to say get rid of LGA too, but that was certainly the implication that he was giving. Let us as city officials raise the taxes locally and make the decisions we need to make, and if the state wants to provide property tax relief, it certainly can do that. So, I'm not advocating that we do that, Madam Chair, but it would seem to me the logic would be the same. If we're going to talk about getting rid of market value homestead credit, we could be having the same conversation around LGA.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton, hate to put you on the spot here, but if you heard about Sam Coles, can you, or Mr. Michael, I think that the way to think, at least the way I think about this, and Rep. Sam Coles and I, my city is similar to some of his cities, but not others. Can you explain the intent of, thousands of legislators for the last 20 years, and what is circuit breaker and individual direct relief programs like the circuit breaker, CTR, as we call it, market value, homestead credit, what is the point of that or the purpose of that versus direct aid to cities and counties like LGA and county aid? Because I think often people think of them as the same thing. I don't. I think of them as individual property tax relief versus equalization for net tax capacity. But can you, not me or Lipson Cold or Mark, thousands of legislators for 20 years or 30 or 40, what have they kind of thought of these buckets of tax relief as?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think they'd have to set up by saying, generally speaking, they think of all of this as property tax relief first. One of the problems with LGA and county program aid and all the general purpose aids to cities and counties has been that it has multiple purposes. And the other main purpose besides property tax relief has been to provide relief to or ensure that local governments that have extraordinary needs or unusually small tax bases can provide some reasonable level of service with a reasonable tax rate. So that's where, LGA differs from PTR or from market value credit, the homestead market value credit, is that it's trying to deal with the fact that there are some cities that have unusually high needs, there are some cities that have unusually low tax bases. This is same for counties as it relates to county program aid, and two-thirds of the services provided by the state are actually provided by local governments. Two-thirds of the revenues collected by the state and local governments is collected by the state. So there has to be some way of, moving the money from who collects it to who actually provides the service, and to do it in some type of reasonable fashion so you are kind of equalizing the burdens across the state. Thank you. Representative Rod.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just listening to Ms. Dalton, and I still come back to, what is a reasonable service? What is that basic service? And I don't think we've ever defined that. And I think that might be a good task for this committee or Representative Marquardt's committee to say, what is this basic service that we're all trying to make sure is funded in a reasonable, through a reasonable level of taxation? I don't know how we can continue discussing the issue unless we actually know that, and we don't. And, I mean, I can have my opinion of what a basic service that cities must provide, and Mayor McGuire can have his opinion of what a basic service is, but in terms of the state statute to fulfill the strategic mission or the strategic objective of LGA, what is that basic service that we're trying to ensure? Because I think that would be not only a good exercise, an important component of ensuring the ability to sell the idea of LGA going forward as it's become kind of a hot potato. The other thing that I wanted to mention is I think what Mayor McGuire is suggesting aligns two things in a much better way than we often discuss them. And you, Madam Chair, mentioned this as well. We often discuss LGA and market value credit in the same breath, where they're two very different things. And when you discuss market value homestead credit and the PTR, now those are more akin in terms of having that discussion. And so I do appreciate, Mayor McGuire, your direction. You know, also, you're coming here and just saying, let me be more self-reliant. And I don't think we ought to say no to that. And I just wanted to say thank you for not only just coming here, but for coming here with some solutions and not just saying, I got to have. You really came forward in a way that I actually wasn't expecting, and I just wanted to publicly say thank you for that.
Thank you. Representative Lanning and West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I continue to be a strong supporter of the PPR program because it's related to income, and that's the approach we ought to take in looking at property tax relief. But I want to caution everyone that doing away with market value homestead credit is going to further exacerbate the problem for cities that get LGA. It's going to add more to the cuts that they're bound to be getting here with this budget crisis we have. It's going to further complicate that. And as you talk about eliminating both LGA and market value homestead credit, for those who don't qualify for PTR, their property taxes are absolutely going to go through the roof. In my city, my residents will have their property taxes more than double if you were to eliminate those programs. More than double. And they wouldn't qualify for PPR relief. So I support PPR, but let's be careful how far we go with that.
Thank you. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Broad, I have an answer to your question. The appropriate... Don't groan, Representative Zoe. About 80% of public safety dollars are spent at the local level. And when we talk LGA, we're talking public safety. 40% of St. Paul's general fund is spent on cops. 40% of Minneapolis general fund is spent on cops. You take suburban cities, some of the cities in rural Minnesota, it's much higher than that. That's the expensive part, is law enforcement. When you talk about cutting that, you're cutting public safety. I think when people say, you know, should we spend more money on cops, most people agree because they want safe neighborhoods. That's true. Because we would disagree, but he needs to be pulled over more often once in a while. I was pulled over in Eden Prairie, Representative Lumen, by a Dodge Charger. You guys are buying Dodge Chargers out there, which is great because I can never outrun a Charger. But the fact is that there are expenses you can make when you pay for your cops off the property tax and you have a growing tax base that we in the city with an aging infrastructure cannot make. I know in the East Metro, if you pull over for a DWI, and I never have been, I think you get taken downtown to the jail downtown, and you take your intoxilizer there. We shoulder a lot of the Metro burden in the inner city. So I just want to say, Madam Chair and Representative Broad, it's law enforcement. That's what we're talking about primarily.
Representative Broad, I agree that law enforcement is a part of it, but it's more than that. And what I'm trying to get to is actually the base level of what cities are expected to provide at what level. And, you know, and it's not rhetoric. It's what is it that we're asking cities to do? And if we're asking them to do, they ought to do it. And if we're not asking them to do it, then they ought to be funded in a different way. And so that's what I'm trying to get down to, is just boil it down to what are we expecting. And I don't think we have that written anywhere.
Mayor McGuire, thank you so much. It's nice that you came and started talking, and you woke everyone up. So that's really great. Did you want to close with anything?
Madam Chair, I appreciate the committee's time and the work that you have. You have some very tough choices, and I can only hope that I've been helpful. Thank you
so much. Really appreciate you being here. Representative Dabney, and then we'll take more testifiers. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Broad, you're asking a good question about what is it we're asking cities to do. And Representative Lesh gave you a good, solid answer in terms of cops, and we can also talk about firefighters, and we can talk about these employers, city attorneys, all playing a part. But if we're going to talk about what are we asking cities to do, I think we need to have a larger conversation as well, because we ask some cities to do more or different things than others. The city of Minneapolis is asked to have a convention center and actually have its property taxpayers pay for some of that convention center. It's not a city of Minneapolis function, it's a state function. That's a state benefit to bring business to Minnesota, to make Minnesota more part of the national and international economy. I think some of your people were knocking around Minneapolis last summer, mostly trying to stay away from Representative Lesh's police force. I think the RNC was in the Twin Cities. Yeah. We host the Target Center. It unfortunately is a city institution, but it serves a regional or statewide function. We host the Metrodome, which thank you. We host three stadiums within the system of Minneapolis: the Metrodome, the upcoming Twin Stadium, and the Gopher Stadium. And we're asking the city of Minneapolis to provide police, fire, prosecution, other public safety and comfort functions too often off of its own tax base when we've asked them to do these things as local, regional, and statewide assets. So I think if we're going to ask what are we asking cities to do, we also need to be sensitive to we ask some cities to do other things, and the two central cities in particular, and as well as the chair's own city ends up with things that are of regional and statewide interest and importance.
Thank you, Representative Jamie. Representative Broad, I was wondering who your people were as well. Representative Broad,
I was trying to figure that out. Well, I appreciate that, because I was perplexed as to who my people were, who might be trying to outrun people and bashing them around, because knowing the people that I represent, that is not the case. And they are just super, super nice people.
As I represent the Dabney's people, Representative Dabney.
Representative Leibing.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I have to jump into this great discussion. I just hearing you talk about, you know, the different burdens on different cities, I just want to say, gosh, we all have our crosses to bear, don't we? I mean, you know, I've really opened the can of worms, Representative Dabney, but what I really, really raised my hand to talk about was that when we're talking about the effect of LGA and County A, the one thing that I really learned from our joint hearing that we had the other day was how the MOE really enters into this. And I just think if we're going to sort this out, and Representative Broad, I actually really kind of agree with you. We really ought to be figuring out. I know, isn't that surprising? We are in this situation financially, and we all know it's not going to get better because we've got these changing population dynamics that we have, and there are things that we're going to have to. We have growing and growing expenses into the future because of the way things are changing in our state. Let's face it, that is just the reality. And we have this complex situation of LGA and County Aid and all these things that we always argue about here, about what goes into the formula and how fair is this and how far is that. But you're taking this complex formula of who gets money, and you're putting it on top of this other formula of how much different people have to pay for stuff. And there seems to me there's very little connection between the two things. And until we sort out this MOE thing, I mean, it just seems crazy. I mean, I hope to have a little discussion with Ms. Dalton about how these two things fit together, because it just seems to me it's like having a bunch of puzzle pieces up here and a bunch of puzzle pieces down here, and we stick them together and they don't necessarily match. I mean, is there fairness in this thing? We do this all with the idea that we want to be fair, which is a great goal, have fairness across the state so that presumably wherever a person lives, they get a basic level of services, and that should be not only, you know, police and fire, but things like, you know, mental health treatment and libraries and all these good things that we want everybody to have a basic level across the state. But it seems to me that the system we have for doing that is, if it gets us there, it's by accident pretty much. So I really would like us to dig into this in a big way and let there be no sacred cows.
Thank you so much. And Representative Weaving gave you a wonderful segue to county needs and MOE. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership consists of 13 of the larger and growing counties. That has one-third of the state's population, if you're interested in the demographics. With me today is Joe Matthews from the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm going to start out with just sort of an overview of what is in the governor's budget, and then Joe is going to address the 15 county regional human services, and then if we have time, I'll just conclude with some recitation of the current efforts that are occurring in sharing and consolidation. First, I want to start out by acknowledging that counties have to share part of the burden of dealing with the deficits facing the state. The numbers are just too large to suggest that we should escape any share of the burden. So I'm not going to be here today whining about don't cut us, don't cut us. Obviously, I want to express concern about the extent of those cuts, but I have to acknowledge at the front end we will have to share in that. But secondly, I want to make it clear to you what's as important as the cuts is what's not in the governor's budget. And those are twofold. First, although the governor's narrative gave extensive comments with regards to the mandates and MOEs, to date there have been no proposals from the administration to reduce those mandates, which, as you know from your previous hearing, is over $237 million annually for counties. We're hopeful that something is going to come from the Department of Revenue on the non-human services side shortly, but we are left into the dark as if we'll receive any maintenance of effort reduction in the human services side, and that's a larger portion of that $237 million. Secondly, the governor has made no proposals for changes in levy limits. And I want to make sure that the committee appreciates how stringent those are going to be in 2010 and 2011. Under current law, based on the November forecast, instead of a 3.9% increase, we're looking at a 2.2% increase. And I'll suggest that when the February forecast comes out, that may even be lower. For 2011, the increase for inflation is even worse at 0.9%. In combination with the aid cuts that we're looking at, that's just an insurmountable amount of fiscal harm that we're looking forward to. So we strongly appreciate anything that the committee can do to provide some relief from those levy limits. I passed out a document that has estimated county aid cuts and repayments with 100% participation in Human Services Delivery Consolidation Program that Mr. Matthews will cut shortly. And I want to make it clear to you that while with cities and townships, you can basically look to what's happening in your budget, that much of what's happening to counties is occurring in other committees, and we want to make sure you realize the extent of those. So I've done the best that I can to capture those programs where we can identify with some specificity what those additional cuts are. For example, we're being asked to repay $32 million of one-time payments we received back in 2008 for what was scheduled to be a cut in what's called targeted case management last year. Congress has since delayed that, but still, we are ultimately facing those cuts, and those will be over $65 million. Tilt payments, it's not being carried in your spreadsheet, but yet in the governor's budget narratives, it's in your responsibility. So I want you to realize for sure that the DNR payments in lieu are an impact on counties. And finally, he's proposing making cuts in what's called MFIP consolidated payments. A significant portion of which goes to pay emergency assistance for individuals receiving welfare who come up against shortages at the end of the month where they don't have enough food, they can't make a rent payment, they can't pay utilities. Obviously, that's increasing in these times, but yet we're being asked to cut back, and basically we're left reliant on our property taxes. So this gives you somewhat of a flavor of the full array of cuts that we're looking at. I want to emphasize it's not everything. It doesn't capture cuts that are occurring for those counties that operate hospitals or nursing homes. It doesn't capture cuts that are occurring in a few corrections programs, such as those in Carver and Olmsted County that are proposed for reduction. But I did want to attempt to make you aware of the array of the cuts across all the committees. I'll turn things over to Mr. Matthews at this point.
Mr. Matthews, we have a question from Rep. Semple.
Real quickly, Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, thank you for your testimony. You indicated that the governor hasn't come out with any proposal yet, the Department of Revenue, with regard to mandates or maintenance of effort relief. Have the counties have a bill in yet? I mean, there's members around this table who I'm sure, myself included, would be happy to work with you on that. You guys have a lot of information. I'd be happy to help you get a bill drafted if there's not already one drafted. I know Representative Davids had an amendment, but do we have a bill in?
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, Representative Coles, we actually have participated in a number of bills and will be introducing shortly a comprehensive bill regarding that AMC is working on that will cover the full inventory of non-human services mandates. Then in addition, we have been working with Representative Thiessen to specifically work on the mental health maintenance of effort.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, thank you for that. I'm glad to hear that. I think that we all spend too much time waiting for the governor to act, and we have the ability to do things here as legislators, and certainly the lobbying community has an ability to work with us to try to get things done, regardless of what the governor may or may not be doing. So I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear you're taking that step. I look forward to working on those issues.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And then we do want to go to Mr. Matthews, and we have a number of testifiers, and we're adjourning at 12. Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Cole, just to that point, I had in early January requested for every program in human services that has a maintenance of effort, whether or not the Department of Human Services has used that maintenance of effort to earn federal dollars, whether those match require what legislative authority they had to use that as a federal match, and whether or not in-kind resources at the local or state level could be used instead of a dollar match. And as of yesterday, our nonpartisan fiscal analyst had just gotten a two-sentence reply back from the Department of Human Services, or maybe it was three sentences. He's following up to try and get that detail. But I've been working with a variety of people trying to address that in the complicated area of human services, but if we can't get the basic information, it's really hard to propose solutions, because you can put in a moratorium and exempt everything that's federally matched, and there's no relief if they've used every dollar.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to mention Representative Loeffler has also been working with representatives of the counties on the maintenance of effort issue.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I just want to echo the comments Mr. Carlson made. I won't rehash those, but I did want to talk about the 15 human services area consolidation, since it is tied to county program aid in the governor's proposal. We really actually do appreciate the governor taking an interest in some government efficiencies. We call it the AMC redesign project, and we want to applaud him for those efforts. And we are looking forward to exploring with him kind of the relationship between the state and counties and how we can make that better. We do have some concerns going forward. We've seen some draft language for the proposal. We haven't seen the final product yet. But our understanding seems to be that the intent is to provide some greater accountability between counties and Human Services Department at the state level, and then also pool some of our expertise. For example, there are some human service programs where county may only have one or two cases a year, and if they can share someone with their neighboring counties, they might be able to get an expert in there to deal with those and make things a little bit faster and more efficient. We also think that if we work together, we might be able to reduce some variability. That said, we're not sure at this point that an arbitrary number of 15 centers or conglomerates or joint powers boards or what have you might be the best way to reach those goals. We think it seems a little bit simplistic, and as I said, we haven't seen the final language, so we're trying not to be too critical at this point. But we're really interested in kind of a form follows function set up for human services and really looking at what we're trying to do and then build a form around that. And I think our counties, by and large, what we've heard across the state is that a number of counties do partner, and Mr. Carlson, I think, will expand on that a little bit further, but they're already partnering, and they may partner with one county for social services and one county for public health and another county for human services, and sometimes it's several counties in those areas. Again, there's a lot of existing relationships. We have not had an opportunity yet to sit down and fully explore those with the governor's office. We look forward to doing that. I think it's important for folks to consider that as we go forward. And I think this does really create an opportunity for us to really look at what our outcomes and goals are in the human services area. On the side, as far as the county program aid goes, we do have concerns about tying that to a human services mandate. You know, I guess, honestly, to put it bluntly, our folks aren't real confident that the next time we balance the budget, that money is still going to be there. However, whatever structure or mandate we agree to in order to earn back some of those aids, that's going to stay. And so I will just say that there's a large reluctance on the part of our members to use program aid for this reason. I do want to say that our members feel that if the state is willing to work with us to find efficiencies and lower costs and improve services, we're really willing to do that. And I don't know that we need to tie it to program aid in that way. And I guess moving forward, I think that it might be more appropriate if the aids are really more on the human services side and less on the property tax side.
Madam Chair, if I could just conclude then. The draft of the 15 regional human services was just made public in the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Committee this morning. And if I were to characterize it, it's frankly long on concepts and very short on the details. For example, there was a question, well, how does this integrate with the existing MOEs? Which, as you know, for example, in the mental health area, varies by a factor of 20 between the highest to the lowest per capita effort for that. And the department had no answer, that they basically said that each county, even though they're in this combined entity, would still have to meet this on an individual basis, which we just frankly say is totally illogical. With regards to combination, you already had some discussion at the prior committee that there are five counties that completely combine right now for human services. But there are many, many examples where counties combine for specific programs, specific services, and I'll just run through a few of them. Right now, Renville, Meeker, and McCloy counties combine for providing waivered services to developmentally disabled. 84 of the 87 counties participate in what are called waivered services for the disabled. 22 counties participate in what are called home and community-based waivered services, and the only reason, frankly, why that has not gone forward is basically it's tied to what are called slots, where these waivered services qualify for federal funding, and the state has cut back on those slots since 2001, and so it hasn't gone forward from that point. I'll just finally conclude, there are examples of two consortiums right now of what are called county-based purchasing, but they're really healthcare entities that operate through the prepaid medical assistance program, or PMAP, services throughout the rural portions of our state. Recently, last session, the counties in the southeastern section of the state tried to create another program along those lines, and the administration vetoed the bill to do that. So in part, the impediments to the sharing and the regionalization have frankly come from the administration that's proposing this consolidation right now. I'll conclude with that.
Thank you. We have further testifiers. We're trying to get everyone through by noon here. Rep. Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is for Mr. Carlson. I appreciate that a bill in the Senate's been introduced and it's long on concept and short on details. We have a time frame in which we need to work, and we're going to have to either put on the path of making difficult choices in terms of cutting, or we can try and make some reform. I often tell the people where I live, I feel like I'm trying to build a house inside a tornado, and I urge you to, you know, join us, as I know you are, and I appreciate your spirit of not whining, and bring a sharp pencil and help us add the detail on that conceptual plan. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Appreciate that. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I know that time is tight, so I'll try to be brief. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I'd like to share two concerns that we have about the governor's tax proposal. The first is the size of the tax cuts in the governor's proposal, which worsen our state's budget deficit in the next biennium and require deeper spending cuts than otherwise would be needed. And the second is the governor's deep cuts to the renter's credit, which makes one of the state's most regressive taxes even more regressive. The governor's budget contains a package of tax cuts that we think the state simply cannot afford. The cost of the package grows over time and costs the state over $450 million in the next biennium in 12-13, and it grows from there. So we think back to the saying, when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing to do is to stop digging. We think it's not now the time, is not the time for a reduction in state revenues of that magnitude. It's also unclear whether that package of tax cuts that the governor proposes would be effective in stimulating growth in the state's economy. But we do know that the governor's deep cuts to the renter's credit will take about $51 million a year out of the state's economy. And those of you on the property tax division heard some testimony that the way that folks use that renter's credit is to fix their car, to buy their kids school supplies and clothes to get ready for school. That money circulates quickly in the local economy and is important for our local merchants. The renter's credit provides a reduction in property taxes for nearly 274,000 low and moderate income Minnesota households. About 28% of those recipients are seniors and persons with severe disabilities, and in greater Minnesota that percentage is much higher, with, I believe, 12 counties in greater Minnesota having more than half of their renter's credit recipients being seniors and people with severe disabilities. They receive an average credit of $550 a year. The governor's proposal would cut the renter's credit by 27% compared to its base in 2011 and also 27% in the next biennium. I think the crucial question to ask about the renter's credit is whether it is effective in meeting its goal, which is reducing the regressivity of the state's property tax system. Rental property taxes are among the most regressive in the state, and that is true even after we take the renter's credit into account. We do have tough choices ahead in addressing this daunting state budget deficit. But only about half of the cuts to aids and credits, including the aids to local government, that the governor proposes in his bill goes to reducing the deficit. The other half goes to pay for the new tax cuts, and that percentage grows in the next biennium. Low-income people, people with disabilities, the elderly, and other vulnerable populations are making a contribution to solving this deficit problem and are being impacted by cuts happening in other committees, similar to what you heard from the county. So we don't think that they should be asked to make an additional contribution here, especially given some of the concerns that I know many members have about the regressivity of our tax system. The legislature has rejected proposals to cut the renter's credit repeatedly in the past, and we would ask you to do so again this year. And I do have a fact sheet about renter's credit recipients by county.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gann. Further testifier. Anyone else who wants to tell us about the governor's budget? Yes, please. And we've done five full committees on the governor's tax area proposal, so I think you're going to be the last person on this. So thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bruce Cox. I'm the Clearwater County Land Commissioner, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners. There's 15 counties with land commissioners in northern Minnesota. We manage 2.8 million acres of tax forfeited land for the benefit of the taxing districts. which include the county general revenue, the school districts, and the township. The governor has proposed a 20% cut in PILT for the biennium, and I just wanted to relate to you a little bit kind of the ramifications of that to us. The purpose of PILT is basically to provide, to offset the disproportionate tax that the local taxpayers pay for services in their taxing districts due to the presence of public land. We living in northern Minnesota, of course, have an abundance of public land, including, besides tax forfeit, we have over 4 million acres of state land, two national forests, Boundary Waters Canoe Area, several state parks. Itasca State Park is in our colony. The purpose of PILT for us has been basically an incentive to maintain that public land base. When people say we should sell land locally to increase the tax capacity in the areas where we work, we can say the state, everybody is paying for those lands to be there, and they pay annually for that. That has helped twofold. One is to keep that incentive to maintain that land base, as well as it very much improves the image of the DNR when they come to the local colonies asking for things. What we're going to be facing with a cut potentially is a loss of that incentive to maintain land. Those 2.8 million acres will be somewhat more vulnerable to county boards trying to make up differences in selling land. Another point I want to make is that 2.8 million acres is somewhat more protective than the 4.3 the state has, just by the way we ended up with them. So you're looking at a potential loss of the more productive public lands with this going on. Another thing I want to say is that there's a whole trend out there from the DNR and others to buy more land. The Lessard Outdoor Heritage Fund has got a lot of pressure to buy more land. And another thing going on is the Forest Legacy. We're spending a huge amount of money to just acquire rights to land, just to take away the development rights. So you're paying 50 cents an acre basically on state land to the counties right now and in lieu to maintain all of the public benefit there, where you're paying millions of dollars to buy development rights on industry land up, you know. I really would ask that you consider, you know, really look at that, and when if this recommendation stands, we really are opposed to any new public land acquisition in the biennium. It just puts a further burden on the local taxing districts, and it's not offset by PILT. So with your time, I'll just close with that. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Cox, for being here. Any questions for Mr. Cox? You got the last word. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And members, we are adjourned. Thank you.